Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 29th of March. This hour of the program, we talk about Afghanistan. The current cover story of Newsweek magazine is Scandal in Afghanistan, the exclusive story of how we've wasted $6 billion on a corrupt and abusive police force that may cost us the war. One of the reporters on this story is T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica. He joined them in 2008 as a senior reporter based in Washington and spent the previous 11 years reporting for the Los Angeles Times. His work has included coverage of the 2000 presidential campaign, 3 years as bureau chief for the Times, responsible for 10 countries in South and Central America. He has worked for the San Francisco Chronicle and the St. Petersburg Times, received a number of awards for his work, and we're happy to have him with us this hour. This looks at the $6 billion that America has spent since 2002 in an effort to create an effective Afghan police force. Ambassador Richard Holbrook, the State Department's top representative in the region, has publicly called the Afghan police an inadequate organization riddled with corruption. And the article goes on to describe just how bad the situation is. T. Christian Miller is our guest. Well, welcome phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. T. Christian Miller, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. Well, it indeed is the gang that can't shoot straight, right? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, right. That was one of the when Newsweek and I were writing the story, when ProPublica was writing the story together, we chose to kind of open it on that image of some Afghan recruits trying to hit and being unable to hit a training target. We thought that was kind of emblematic of the issue of if you can't have a police force who can't even hit a target, you've got problems.
Yeah. Now, the police force that we're supposedly training, is it a counterinsurgency force, or is it a force that's just to protect people in various communities in Afghanistan?
Well, you've asked one of the most important questions about the entire police force, which is, who are they? Are they supposed to be police like we have in this country who are patrolling the streets and looking out for crime and investigating bad things that occur in their cities? Or are they supposed to be more like SWAT teams or paramilitary forces who are sort of defending the population from attacks by the Taliban? And what you've seen, one of the problems is you never have clarity of purpose by the U.S. government as to what exactly the police should be doing. Should they be beat cops on the street, or they should be more like military soldiers helping out the soldiers? And so you've had a variety of different training that's happened over the years that's kind of left with no one clear purpose for any of these guys.
Mm-hmm. And who are these people? You describe them as people who are, for the most part, not literate, and anybody who applies pretty much can get in.
Right. Newsweek's reporter in Afghanistan, Ron Moreau, did quite a lot of work on this topic. And as it turns out, it was very interesting. The Afghan National Army actually has a better reputation than the police. And it's driven, obviously, Afghan recruit from the same Afghan people as the army, as the police do. But in the army's case, they pay much better. So what we sort of found out was that the army pays better, so they're going to get sort of the cream of the crop amongst Afghans who want to do this sort of work. The Taliban actually pay better than the police, so you'll get some people who go to the Taliban. And so the Afghan National Police, which for many years was the worst-paying outfit in town, got the worst recruits, of course, the guys who were the least skilled. And so you had a recruit force which was very, very difficult to train. These were Afghans who didn't speak English anywhere from, weren't literate. Anywhere from 80 to 90% of them couldn't read or write. They, of course, did not speak English. They spoke local languages, and the police trainers didn't speak their language, so there was a language barrier. You had drug use amongst many of these guys. ranging nationally from 15% of the recruits were actually tested positive for some sort of drugs, up to 60%, as high that high.
Wow.
In some particular areas. So these were not what you would call your highest quality recruits that were brought in to become police officers.
And who's doing the training? Is it contractors? Is it organizations like Blackwater?
By and large, most of the training right now in Afghanistan is done by a single contract company, which is called DynCorp International. Blackwater also does training of the border police. Those are like the guys around the border of Afghanistan. But the bulk of the police that you would see in Afghanistan are being trained by a company called DynCorp International.
Mm-hmm. And we have spent $6 billion to get a police force up and running. $6 billion?
Right. If you add up all of the money that the U.S. has contributed, and that includes things like building police academies, purchasing uniforms, weapons. $2 billion was just spent paying DynCorp money to do their actual training itself. The bill is somewhere around $6 billion, although no one will tell you that we have that figure down to the penny, because there's been a lot of strange accounting in this whole process as well.
Mm. You write in the article, the worst of all of this is that the police are central to Washington's plans for getting out of Afghanistan. How are the police central?
Well, from the very beginning, just 2 months after President Obama took office, in March of 2009, he publicly declared, we're going to have a new strategy in Afghanistan, and we're going to pay attention to Afghanistan. And one of the central points of his speech was, in order to get U.S. soldiers out of harm's way, we need to make the Afghan army and the Afghan police an effective force so they can get in there and they can protect the Afghan people and they can fight off the Taliban. So President Obama himself sort of made this his personal effort and mission from very early on. And the idea is that if you're going to withdraw troops from July of 2011, which is the announced idea in any case, you need to have an effective police force to stay behind so that you don't have your capitals, your cities, your rural areas overrun again and return to what Afghanistan looked like pre-2001.
So these people have gone through some kind of training. This thing is, everything about the article is pretty alarming. Even if these people, and I would imagine that many of them, if they can't hit their target, fail their firearms tests, that's okay. They're issued a weapon and they're put on the street.
That's another one of the I thought the revealing moments was that ultimately, this is not like going to high school where you can fail out and not get your diploma. These are only 8-week courses for basic training. And so you go to this 8-week course, and essentially if you show up every day, don't drop out, at the end of the 8 weeks, you will become a police officer. And it doesn't really matter if you're not so good at hitting a target. It doesn't really matter if you're able to cite basic human rights regulations that are written from the Afghan Constitution. You get to go back to your home village or area and become a police officer with a badge, which actually, as one commander pointed out to us, makes them more likely to become corrupt, because now they have sort of a official authority that allows them to stop people on the road or set up a checkpoint and demand money or bribes to be allowed to proceed forward. So you're creating, in some extent, for at least some of these guys, you're creating the possibility of more corruption.
And is that indeed happening, that they are corrupt once many of them are? Did you look at that?
Oh, sure. There was a number of people who spoke to us, both here in Washington, D.C., and in interviews that I did with many former DynCorp trainers spread around the country, and with everyday Afghans. I mean, it's very hard to find someone who says who won't tell you a story about corruption amongst the Afghan police. I mean, they are notoriously a corrupt force.
Uh-huh. What about accounting for all of this money? It would seem as if you're spending that kind of money, you would want to make sure that it's used properly, that you're getting some results, you're getting some really good police officers, or why do this and why keep doing this for years and years and years?
Yeah, I think any of us, if we were working in a private corporation and this had been our job, would have been fired by now. There are actually no metrics, no sort of statistics, really, that they use to gauge whether or not a police officer is trained. It's a numbers thing. If you put 1,000 people through an academy, you get credit for 1,000 police officers. Whether or not that officer can do anything or perform his job, there literally there was an audit report done recently by the State Department and the Defense Department, which said there's just no standards at all to measure whether or not this program is working. And in terms of that, so that's actual the police officers. And then in terms of the accounting, the money side of it, again, in that same audit by the Department of Defense, Department of State, it just pointed out that there's hundreds of millions of dollars which they've got, haven't been able to find invoices for. They don't really know whether or not the weapons or the uniforms or the meals were actually served or not. So it's an accounting fiasco.
Goodness. And you write that there was some kind of audit that found that state routinely short-staffed its contract monitoring office. So at one point, you only have 3 contract officers on the ground overseeing DynaCorp's $1.7 billion training contract.
Right. I mean, imagine hiring a contractor for your own house and how closely you pay attention to what that contractor is doing and spending and things like that. And, you know, that's for you and your own little house. Now, what we, the U.S. government, has for a $1.7 billion remodeling job in Afghanistan, you've got one guy. You know, just imagine how difficult, or you have 3 guys. Imagine how difficult or impossible, really, it is to monitor how well that money is being spent, how that money is getting spent out the door.
Mm-hmm. The people who seem to be having a better job, at least training people how to shoot straight, are the Italians. What's their involvement here?
Well, another one of the complicated things about this story is there are so many cooks in the kitchen. So you have the State Department has a role, the Defense Department has a role, NATO has a role, the European Union has a role, and then the Afghan government, of course, all has a role. So you have all these different sort of political actors who have different agendas going on. In the particular case with the Italian police force, which are known as the Carabinieri, they are part of the NATO mission, which also has a responsibility for training some of the police officers. Now, we can't over-exaggerate that. The total number of Carabinieri in the country numbers in the scores versus the primary trainers remain DynaCorp International, which has, I think, upwards of 600 or 700 people in the country.
Hmm. What do you make of the president's visit to Afghanistan, this really short 6 hours on the ground over the weekend?
I think that one of his chief messages to President Karzai was corruption. Mm. That's been one of the chief messages of the administration, from Ambassador Holbrook to Secretary Clinton, Secretary Gates, and to President Obama, of course. They've all stressed that if you don't have a handle on corruption, you're not going to have respect for the government amongst the Afghan people. And if you don't have that, then what are we doing there? What kind of a government are you creating? The Taliban will move in and establish themselves as a viable alternative to a corrupt government. So the Afghan police, what's interesting about the Afghan police is it brings us these two very important issues, which is training a police force to protect the Afghan people and reducing corruption together in one place. I mean, under the perfect world, you'd have a well-trained police force that cracks down in corruption. In today's version, you have a not very well-trained police force that actually augments the amount of corruption.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to take phone calls, and here's how you reach us. Our guest this hour is T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica, and he is one of the primary authors of the piece in Newsweek magazine, March 29 issue, Scandal in Afghanistan, the exclusive story of how we have wasted $6 billion on a corrupt and abusive police force that may cost us the war. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. The email address, in case you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. T. Christian Miller, our guest this hour. is with ProPublica, senior reporter based in Washington, has written for the Los Angeles Times and has also written for bureau chief of the Times in South and Central America, worked for the San Francisco Chronicle, St. Petersburg Times, and is one of the lead authors of this piece in the current issue of Newsweek. We start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
May I ask a question of your guest in that, is this a program distinct from a NATO program or programs in that I understand that the Canadians and the Germans have had or do have police training programs, you know, this sort of civil reconstruction type programs. So is that also going on? And a second question, perhaps the commitment to Afghanistan is a long-term commitment fitting into this long war scenario. And so we're looking at programs that are meant to justify a longer commitment. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Frank, those are both really great questions. Yes, you are correct that there are also other NATO countries, Canada, Germany, Italy, are also participating in the training mission. They're all under united, at least theoretically united, under a single overall command called the NATO Training Mission, NTM. And the purpose there is to be able to coordinate the U.S., which is Dying Corps trainers, the Italians and their Carabinieri together. And so what ends up happening in practice is that you can go to different bases at different places in Afghanistan, and you'll see different groups will be training. So in one base, there'll be Germans training. In one base, there'll be American contractors training. And that's how it actually functionally breaks up. Part of the problem, part of the issue that you'll hear is that these people are all working off of different playbooks. So one group may be focused more on community policing. One group may be focused more on firearms training, let's say. And so you don't have an overall coordination. That's an overall issue. But, yes, there are certainly other countries that are participating in. As a little side note, none of those other countries as of yet has completely fulfilled the commitments it has made to supply trainers, police officers, to this mission. And so a complaint you'll hear privately, at least amongst American generals, is that these other countries haven't stepped up completely to fulfill all their slots, not necessarily. Mm. The second question, is this a long-term commitment? Yes, it is a long-term commitment, everyone says, to possibly be able to produce a police force of any credibility. That will take many, many, many years. As a additional note, there was recently a cost estimate generated which said to keep and maintain the Afghan army and Afghan police functioning each year is a minimum of $10 billion per
Goodness
year.
Goodness gracious.
And that's on, and of course, that's almost equal to about half of Afghanistan's GDP right now. So the nation of Afghanistan will not be able to support or afford that level of commitment any time within foreseeable future, which means that somebody is going to be on the hook for $10 billion a year.
Whew. Thanks, Frank, for your call, as always. Roger from Chicago. Hi. Roger, are you there?
Yeah, hi. How are you?
All right, Roger. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. Calling from the road around Menominee.
Okay.
You know, my comment is, how can the blind lead the blind? You know, when you know all the politicians and all the government officials, when they are looking at money, they're corrupt. How can you expect a corrupt operation to teach another country not to be corrupt? It doesn't work. You know, we've got too much corruption in our own that we could see, but yet nobody does anything about it because the government's too big. How do you expect third world countries that don't have enough money to eat what one person makes in this country to make for them in about 3 years? How do you expect them not to be corrupt at the turn of a hat? It's not possible.
Chief.
Well, Roger's hit on it. Corruption is one of the most difficult problems to solve, and any sort of study by any international group like the World Bank has said that for many years. It's an insidious problem because once it gets rooted in there, it's very difficult to get rid of. It is obviously, as Roger said, very understandable why someone who's making a few dollars a day for his family would not mind taking additional money to feed his wife and kids. So it is a very difficult problem to stamp out, both in this country, of course, and in any country. That said, it is most international development people, most auditors and watchdog types will say you have got to make an attempt to combat it, because what's the other option? The other option is to just let it flourish and become a completely corrupt society. So you've got to take what steps you can, and they're not. Nobody has a magic bullet here, but if you don't, you end up with a government that is nothing but a money-taking machine.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you highlight in the article is that it would be good as a police officer to know how to fire a weapon. I think that would be a given. But you also talk about the fact that people say that the police do not have good relations with people. We're trying to train them to respect and relate to people. If such a skill is teachable at all, it could be far more important in the long run than knowing how to shoot straight.
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's the idea that a primary distinction between a police force and a military force is that the police are in the town doing community policing. They're not defending from terrorists. Their idea is to kind of get to know people and make sure that shop owners are protected and safe, and that people can walk down the streets. And it's much more of a civilian-based function in a normal functioning country, of course. And so that's one of the big, as I said earlier, it's one of the big back and forth in this, is that ideally you would have police who would be there doing what cops do in Wisconsin and cops do in California and cops do in New York. But it's not an ideal country, obviously. So how do you find that balance between a police officer who will know the local shop owners and can, be a friendly face of the government that people can trust versus, these guys get attacked and killed. I mean, the Afghan police die at a rate 3 times what the Afghan National Army does.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they're much more likely to be targeted. They're cops out on roadsides by themselves. They're in two-man mud hut stations in the middle of nowhere. And they're a very convenient target because they look like the Afghan government. They got a little badge on their shoulder, so the Taliban wipes them out. They don't have the arms, they don't have the training, but the Taliban can claim a victory. They've attacked the government. And so these guys, they just get slaughtered.
Mm. Oh, thank you, Roger, for your call. Habu is next from Madison. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning to you, and thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat skeptical of what I'm hearing here, but before I make my 2 points, an aside about President Obama, President Bush, visiting the far reaches of the Imperium like a thief in the night, unannounced, and come in there and give this jive talk, and then he talks down to Karzai about corruption. My goodness, yes, there's plenty of corruption in Afghanistan. I'm not an apologist for that, but what has been perpetrated on Wall Street and what we're seeing with healthcare, etc., this place is the mother of all corruption areas. But that's another story.
That's another story, Habu, yeah.
the 2 points I want to make is the whole notion that the United States can go to a place like Afghanistan, impose its will in the air, etc., and then say, okay, we're going to train the police force. The police force are meant to just keep law and order within society, within small areas of society. They can't deal with the Taliban who are coming in with RPGs and machine guns, submachine guns. And so naturally they are a casualty, and also their loyalties are divided because they have to go back to their villages and they get fingered. These are the people who are doing the who are the lackeys of the empire. So that whole notion of building a police force is built on quicksand. Just like the empire, the United States will never be able to maintain control there because those people are fiercely independent.
Tea.
Yes, he's raising a bunch of excellent points. I mean, there was not a true national police force, or has not been a true national police force in Afghanistan since the days of the Russian occupation. And even then, you wouldn't really argue that was a police force as so much an instrument of the state repression. So it's not like Afghanistan has a history of there being a national police force. And an important distinction here to make is in Iraq, where you had a police state and you did have a national police, national identity. And we wouldn't, of course, want to duplicate that police model, but there was a sense there was a national infrastructure of the state. In Afghanistan, that doesn't exist. So the idea, it is to some degree a Western model to come in and say, well, of course we're going to have a national police force, and they're going to patrol the highways like our highway patrol does, or they're going to patrol the streets like our police officers do, and everything will be hunky-dory. In point of fact, you never had a national police force where you are literally starting from ground zero in Afghanistan. I mean, just there was just nothing there before.
Nothing. There's no history at all of a national police force.
Not in any real meaningful sense for decades.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's. Habu, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ellen from Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a concerned citizen, and I'm wondering why we're doing this all in such a bad way, and how can we really, really do something good for Afghanistan, or if we can't, why don't we just leave?
Alan, I think it's a question that a lot of people ask, and that's a question for which there is no easy answer. Certainly, the president has indicated that he wishes to get out of the country by 2011. Whether or not that happens, we'll see. Afghanistan certainly is a country which has lots of problems which are not going to be solved between now and 2011.
Hmm. And do you think that this will... We've talked about this certainly before, create down the road, and maybe sooner rather than later, substantial problems for this administration? It is such a quagmire, isn't it?
Well, there's a phrase that we've heard often enough. This is Obama's war, and there's some truth to that. I mean, certainly there was the Bush presidency spent 7 years prior to the Obama presidency prosecuting this war. But that said, Obama, for better or for worse, has sort of inherited this, and he has to take that on his shoulders. Will it eventually backlash down the road? It's just something which I wish anybody knew the answer to. You will have arguments all day and all night from people who do rebuilding of countries and people who think we should never be in that business at all about success or failure of previous efforts, and sometimes they'll point to places that succeeded, countries we succeeded in, and there's plenty of places where we did not, but each country is different, each situation is different. So being able to predict the future on any model of the past is a very, very tricky thing to do.
Right. Thanks, Ellen, for your call. Virginia is next from Janesville. Hello, Virginia.
Hi. I just wanted to say to Ellen very quickly, Ellen, you can't listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and feel good about Afghanistan. You've got to listen to the military channels and try to get your news in a balanced way. You got to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, but you have to go other places as well. And what we're hearing today is that there's no hope in regarding the police training in Afghanistan, as usual. But my question is specifically, there is a global Institute for Inclusive Security, which trains Muslim women in countries all over the world to become part of the police force. They're armed, they're trained, and they have all-women units, and they guard domestic violence shelters and generally handle women's issues. And I wanted to know that was supposed to be happening in Afghanistan. Condi Rice was starting it in Iraq.
And I want to know if it's going on at all now or if Obama has ended all those efforts. And I'll take my answer off.
All right, Virginia, thanks.
It's an excellent question, Virginia. That has definitely been a focus, actually, under both the Bush administrations and the Obama administration, to create a female component or to recruit women to join the police force. In Iraq, that has succeeded to some extent, but in Afghanistan, that has proven to be an incredibly, incredibly difficult effort. So all the numbers are squishy. There's around 98 to 100,000 police officers now in Iraq, of whom about 300 or 400 are women. So, and those particular female officers who are quite courageous, their job is to do exactly what you said, which is they tend to focus on crimes against women, domestic violence, sexual assault, and things like that. Now, they have been specifically targeted by the Taliban. So a very senior-ranking female police official was killed, assassinated recently. There were several others in the past that have been targeted for assassination and harassment because the Taliban obviously do not tolerate the idea of a female police officer. So it is it's an effort which the State Department continues to try and have and train a female police force. The actual, until very recently, the American general who's in charge of the police training, General Anne McDonald, was a female, and she tried to make this part of that effort. It is just culturally very difficult. It's a very violent place. You run a very high risk if you join the police force. So if training the Afghan police in general is difficult, training a female component to that force is 10 times that difficult.
Mm. Can you talk, there was so much investigation of Blackwater and wrongdoing on the part of Blackwater in Iraq. Can you tell me about a little bit more about DynCorp and why we're relying on them, and if indeed they're much more expensive than having the U.S. Army join forces with NATO countries to help train the police?
DynCorp has a long history in doing police training. They've been doing police training as far back as Haiti after the 1996 invasion of Haiti, the intervention in Haiti. And they have done that in Kosovo, and they've done it in the Balkans, and they've done it in Iraq as well. So DynCorp has long done, had some sort of international police training mission. And so when the wars happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, they actually already had an existing contract to do police training, and that's how they ended up on the ground there. DynCorp has not had nearly the notoriety, of course, that Blackwater has. They've had a number of audits which have raised questions about their accounting and about the kind of material they have delivered, but they haven't certainly reached the notoriety that the Blackwater has. And in terms of the U.S. Army being able to do it, the military is not going to make any bones about this. They can't. There's not enough soldiers who themselves are police trainers to be able to train this. I mean, the U.S. military has a military police force, but that military police force has a certain number of trainers who are training them. So it's not like we have a lot of extra police trainers lying around in the U.S. military to be dispatched to Afghanistan. And so that means kind of going out and hiring a contractor, and who they mostly hire are sheriffs, deputies, and police officers from American police forces. That's who generally is doing the training in Afghanistan.
Hmm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is the main writer for the piece in Newsweek this week, Scandal in Afghanistan. It's the cover story of the magazine, the exclusive story of how we have wasted $6 billion on a corrupt and abusive police force that may cost us the war. The number, 800-486-8655. Our lines are open for you right now. Or the email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica. And he has also worked at the Los Angeles Times for a number of years, was a bureau chief responsible for 10 countries in South and Central America. He worked for the San Francisco Chronicle and the St. Petersburg Times and has received a number of awards for his work. We're talking about the cover story in this week's issue of Newsweek. Let me quote from the article. You know, I almost wonder if this didn't prompt the weekend visit on the part of the president to Afghanistan. You write, more than a year after Barack Obama took office, the president is still discovering how bad things are. At a March 12 briefing with his senior advisors, he asked whether the police will be ready when America's scheduled drawdown begins in July of 2011. According to a senior official who was in the room, it's inconceivable, but in fact, for 8 years, we weren't training the police. We just never trained them before. All we did was give them a uniform. The president looked stunned. 8 years, he said, and we didn't train police? It's mind-boggling. The room was silent.
Yeah, that was one of one of the eye-opening scenes for me in doing the reporting, is when we were given that description by a senior official in the administration. The point here was that you have this very senior general briefing the President of the United States more than a year after he's taken office, saying that everything we've been doing hasn't been very helpful. And the president just kind of looking around the room, and in the room is Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Gates, all the top advisors, and him just saying this is mind-boggling, and then there's just silence afterwards, which I think is just an indication of how stunned everyone was at how far there is left to go after how much money and time has been spent.
Yes. We go to Christopher from Rockford next. Hi, Christopher.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, if we can't compete with the Taliban financially, why don't we work on cutting off the funds to the Taliban so the only good job that there is to work for the Afghan police department?
That's a good question. Recently, and that was the focus of a reform review that was done over the summer, and the pay rates were raised so that now the Afghan police make about as much as the Afghan National Army, who make hopefully a little bit more than the Taliban do. But, of course, that's 8 years into this. So that increased pay is just now beginning to have the effect in being able to really be competitive for recruits. Now, additional problem always in Afghanistan is that a lot of these recruits are then themselves recruited away by private security contractors who benefit from the training given to Afghans, and they want to have a local Afghan security firm. So they do that. That's another issue. But in terms of taking away the financing for the Taliban, that's been an ongoing attempt, and that's what a lot of the drug eradication is about, a lot of sort of cracking down on financial transfers of money, but you know, money is like water. It can get squished around anywhere. It's very difficult to do that in an effective way.
Somebody had this interesting suggestion in the Times, I think yesterday or the day before. We ought to buy up all the opium and get it to the pharmaceutical industry around the world, and we would eradicate it right away, right?
Right. We actually do. You know, there are actually contracts to buy opium from some countries by medical producers. And you know, one of the things that has been discussed is the U.S. using its leverage to be able to purchase some of those crops in Afghanistan. That's a whole other complicated issue on how exactly you go about doing that. But, you could certainly make that attempt.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Christopher. Diane is next from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. Good program, and good for Newsweek. I have a copy of that magazine. I've subscribed to Newsweek now because they're doing a better job. My question is, you know, you talked about these private contractors. You know, a lot has been written about Blackwater, and you just mentioned another one. A name escapes me. My question is, you know, we train for the military, for the police, and then they go in, leave the military, or leave, you know, our police departments here in the United States and trot over to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was wondering what the salaries are like when they get over there? How do they compare to the salaries that they're earning here in the United States in the police departments as compared to going over there?
Oh, they're much higher, Diane. The I think Dying Corps, a police officer used to work in South Carolina, North Carolina, was making, I believe, something like $30,000 a year, and he signed up for Dying Corps and immediately was making $120,000 a year. So when you can increase your salary that much, it's very attractive.
So we as taxpayers are training these people, and then they turn around and reap the benefits of our taxpayer dollars training them and don't bother staying here in the United States but end up going over to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Correct. That's a very common criticism, and then the police departments will – the only counter criticism is that a lot of times these folks will turn to the police department they came from, and will have new sets of skills which they can bring back.
Hmm. It has to be incredibly dangerous work, though, isn't it?
It can be quite dangerous, although for the many of the Dying Corps folks are trainers at police academies, so those police academies are well protected. It certainly is dangerous when they're moving about on the roads to go from point A to point B, yes. But where you see the real high casualty rates is when the Afghan police have been dispatched back on their own out to some remote police station or checkpoint and then are attacked by Taliban fighters.
I guess the other thing that really concerns me, too, on the larger scale is an international police force. You know, obviously, we have our CIA that's involved in that, and sometimes, even though the FBI isn't supposed to, they find out ways to do that, and then they plug into intel. So I guess my real concern, too, is this big international police force or state, you know, and how to really address that and control that so it doesn't become a serious problem in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Diane.
I appreciate the program very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Thanks for your call. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, T, about that?
No, other than I don't think the Afghan National Police will be joining any kind of international police force anytime soon.
Robert from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I can give you a couple answers to the past things. For one thing, Blackwater actually has free videotapes. That's really equivalent to all the police training. There really isn't that much complication. And some of those salaries are representative of not having insurance. And so some of these guys are self-insuring. And no, it's not dangerous. Statistically, it's less dangerous than any construction job, probably including putting up drapes, by the way. So let's not go that direction. As far as the I just happen to be listening on my phone, but as far as the opium deal, you might want to read a book by McCoy. He's a professor down at Madison, The Politics of Heroin. And we have increased the productivity using the CIA out of that region of the world from 140 tons, I think, a year to 4,000 tons a year. We did that back in 84 when we wanted the Russians out of Afghanistan, and we did it again in 2003 when we wanted to go in there. We went in there with bales of money, and we bought up opium. So we increased the productivity to the Western world. We took delivery and redistributed it with the British, and that's the way that one worked. So here's what I got to get to because I think it's a huge point. One thing you've done here so far, it said this is a highly lucrative business for somebody to be in the middle of, and it's huge money at a time when I don't think we have money to do this, and I don't think we should spend money doing this, and that's what it's costing the American public. And this is not going to stop until I hate to say it this way. It's not about subscribing this or prescribing this. It's not going to stop until the streets are burning or until you riot, just like Vietnam wouldn't have stopped under any other condition because there's too much money at the top. And then all the other sellouts, mostly the media, will just fall right in line and take their money and keep repeating the same gibberish that I already discounted. Just two of them. I could discount your other stuff, too, some of it, but I don't have all the time in the day to do that. And you don't have the time in your program to listen.
T.
I'm not quite exactly sure. I mean, certainly in the issue of heroin production has increased dramatically since the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan. There's no disputing that. The Taliban were actually pretty aggressive about cracking down on heroin until the very last years of their regime. So heroin production has flourished in Afghanistan since then. And then on the issue of Blackwater and then training and things like that, I'm not sure exactly what the point was there, but yes, Blackwater guys certainly do face risks over there, and actually they do receive insurance. It's paid for by taxpayers as part of their contract policy. So they do get life insurance and medical insurance. That's part of the contract. You pay for them. They're not self-insured. They're insured by us. And I, in terms of training videos, I don't know that anyone would think that a training video would necessarily replace hands-on training. The question is whether or not any sort of amount of training and how long you have to do that training will have an effect.
Do you see any parallels here with Vietnam?
Between Afghanistan and Vietnam? You know, I'm not familiar, specifically on this police training question, if that's what you're asking, I'm not familiar enough with...
No, not on police training, in terms of you know, mismanagement, in terms of not letting the American people know the truth here, in terms of sinking quietly into the mud on policy and not leaving early enough, et cetera.
Well, I think you can draw... That's what one of the things I was saying earlier, is you can be drawn into endless arguments about... previous countries and the history of those conflicts and whether or not the U.S. was successful or not. And honestly, every single country does seem to be such a specific thing you were facing. That was the middle of the Cold War. You were facing, you had many, many, many more troops in Vietnam. You had two Cold War powers basically fighting a proxy war. You don't have any of that present here in Afghanistan. Could you ultimately muddle through in Afghanistan? Sure, it's a possibility. Could it ultimately be a graveyard of empires, as Afghanistan has known for? You know, that's its history. So it's very dangerous in general to make any kind of firm predictions about what's going to happen in the future on the basis of what's happened in past conflicts. In generally speaking, in my opinion, because they're so different, there's so many different factors involved that it's just hard to do that.
It's just you read the article, T, and the task seems almost impossible.
It does seem almost impossible, and that's getting back to the long-term question, which is how long of a commitment do you want to make? If we stay there for 20 years and we spend $10 billion a year for 20 years, is there a higher chance of having a good, well-trained police force? Sure, I would take that bet. Is anybody going to sit and wait and spend $10 billion a year for the next 20 years? It's very difficult to imagine the political fortitude of the American
people
to last that long.
It's a long time. Thank you, Robert. We go to Ken for probably our final call from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I heard a long time ago, because I wondered about the poppies and the heroin it's producing from Afghanistan. It's caused problems here in our hometown. And the reason that nothing's being done about it is because of the cotton lobby and the United States Southern senators and congressmen, because they would grow cotton down there, and they don't want it to happen, is why...
they would grow cotton in Afghanistan instead of poppies? Is that
correct?
I see.
I can't say that I've ever heard that, Ken. Poppies are certainly a far more lucrative crop than cotton is on any kind of a economic calculus you do, so I don't know exactly how you'd wean them off of the poppies and onto to growing cotton, although that's one of the alternative development strategies now, is to try and increase the production of like fruits like pomegranates and wheat as well. It's a matter of economics. Until poppies become too expensive to grow, either because you're enforcing the law and cracking down and arresting people, or because demand drops and it becomes very cheap and risk is not worth it, it's going to You know, if something costs a lot of money, you can sell it for a lot of money, people are going to do it.
Right. All right, we've got 20 seconds left. What should we do?
I wish I knew the answer. I know that there are efforts being made right now to fix this and to centralize it, at the very least, to create a sense of accountability. And to me, a bottom line is that there should be one person, one agency in charge, so there is an accountability line so that we can say definitively, you're the one who's got to fix this, and we don't have that right now.
Mm. Well, it's a very dramatic, important article. Thank you, T. Christian Miller, for being with us and for writing it. Thanks.
Thanks.
T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica. He spent 11 years with Los Angeles Times, and he also worked for the San Francisco Chronicle and the St. Petersburg Times, and has received a number of awards for his work. The article we're referencing appearing, it's the cover story, actually, of Newsweek magazine for March 29, Scandal in Afghanistan, the exclusive story of how we've wasted $6 billion on a corrupt and abusive police force that may cost us the war. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening and calling, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead.